empathetic leadership, as we've seen in New Zealand, helps. But actually, Australia has got a different style of government, and they've also succeeded. But really, the best performing country on earth has actually been Taiwan, I think, because they acted very early. They didn't need a lockdown, and that was because they had a very strong public health agency, and they started managing their borders in January, and they did everything right. So I think they've had
Michael
a model
Baker,
response.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue with a post show and post online at democracynow.org. From New Zealand, I'm Amy Goodman, Luan Gonzalez. Be safe.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, multiple workers at a Vancouver, Washington fruit processing plant have tested positive for COVID-19. The Memorial Day holiday drew crowds of people ignoring coronavirus restrictions, and four officers involved in the death of a black man in Minnesota have been fired. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 26, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Tuesday afternoon, there are 3,967 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. 148 people with the virus have died. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 18 new positive cases and one presumptive case of the novel coronavirus. Presumptive cases are people who have not yet tested positive but have COVID-19 symptoms and have had close contact with someone who is confirmed to have been infected with the virus. Officials reported no new coronavirus-related deaths for the second day in a row. The Oregon Unemployment Department released a statement on Tuesday saying they have a backlog of 38,000 claims due to the pandemic. Department Director Kay Erickson said, quote, Oregon is facing unprecedented unemployment, and hundreds of thousands of Oregon families are counting on unemployment benefits to pay for their basic needs. While the Oregon Employment Department has paid a record number of Oregonians within 2 to 3 weeks, for too many Oregonians, their claims are in a backlog. End quote. The department announced it is launching a new strategy called Project Focus 100 to process the claims backlog as quickly as possible. The project includes strategies such as hiring a surge staff, focusing on the oldest and most complex claims, increasing proactive communication, and using technology to close gaps and improve service. Nationally, at least 1.6 million people have tested positive for the virus, and at least 98,600 patients in the U.S. have died. Globally, the pandemic has sickened more than 5.5 million people across at least 177 countries. At least 347,500 people have died. Clark County has halted its plans to reopen as a Vancouver food processing plant said that many of its workers have tested positive for coronavirus. Vancouver Fruit Processing Facility confirmed on Monday that 40% of its employees have tested positive for COVID-19. Firestone Pacific Foods says 65 employees have tested positive, 87 have tested negative, and a few remain untested. No hospitalizations due to those coronavirus infections have been reported from the company at this time. An initial outbreak was detected on May 17th, which shut down the production facility, but the numbers of infected people have continued to rise over the last several days, with Friday, May 22nd showing an infection number at 38. This appears to be the largest workplace outbreak in the area, excluding healthcare workers. Clark County Public Health has been working with the plant to get all employees tested and to ensure that CDC guidelines are being followed. The health department announced Monday that it is tracing any contact made by the infected employees to others in order to discover if any families or household members have also contracted the virus. With production halted until May 28th, Firestone Pacific hopes to get approval from the county to reopen, with mandatory testing and major follow-up protocols for the workers wanting to return to their jobs. The outbreak has put the brakes on Clark County being eligible to enter Phase 2 of Washington's reopening plan, with no new timeline on the table as to when the county may proceed with the opening of barbershops, restaurants, and salons, among other businesses that are currently shuttered. Due to the conditions of food processing plants where workers are often in close proximity to each other, these facilities have become one of the most common breeding grounds for the novel coronavirus. Oregon has had two such outbreaks in plants located in Astoria and Albany. Gig workers make up about one-tenth of the workforce, and that number is expected to rise during the coronavirus pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, workers for online platforms who shop for groceries and deliver food have become essential for people stuck at home, but they face an uphill battle for recognition as well as remuneration. Heidi Carrico is a Portland-based grocery shopper for the app Instacart and founding member of the Gig Workers Collective. She says she stopped shopping for Instacart and officially went on strike in March because the risk of contracting the virus wasn't worth the pay.
Being called household heroes and that sort of thing, that speaks to our heart and soul and what we want to do. We want to help our communities. We want to, but that can't take the place of being able to support our own families.
The Gig Workers Collective is a collection of 11 labor activists, all women, across the country, and has been organizing strikes against companies like Instacart, Grubhub, and Postmates. They're calling for protective equipment, hazard pay, and access to paid time off. After a protest organized by the collective on March 30th, Instacart responded by rushing out 10,000 kits of protective equipment. A spokesperson for Instacart says the company has invested $20 million in the last few months to support the health and safety of shoppers. The gig economy is a growing slice of the labor market. Bureau of Labor Statistics data from 2017 found about 1 in 10 workers is part of this economy. Ballooning unemployment numbers from the pandemic likely will cause numbers to rise. Instacart has about 500,000 shoppers across the country and responded to increased demand by announcing a plan to hire 250,000 more in April. But Carrico worries about how these workers will protect themselves.
I'm seeing a lot of really clever and creative things that people are doing to stay healthy. But if you can't afford it, then you're kind of working without a safety net and hoping you don't get sick. I mean, crossing your fingers.
The Gig Workers Collective has been active since Instacart changed the algorithm for its delivery payments, making working for the company unsustainable in the eyes of some workers. Carrico says this has been the case across the gig economy.
All gig workers, regardless of the situation, regardless of whether there's a pandemic or not, deserve a living wage.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon schools may be reopening their classroom doors this fall following months of remote learning and empty buildings during the coronavirus pandemic. The director of the Oregon Department of Education, Colt Gill, told KGW that school staff, parents, and students will have a better idea of what to expect as early as June regarding the reopening of schools in September. The department has been working closely with the Oregon Health Authority to finalize conditions to open amid COVID-19, with Gill saying, quote, "We're working really hard to ensure that school next year is going to be a safe place to be." Governor Kate Brown applied orders across the state in March, closing public schools in attempts to slow the spread of the disease, while teachers scrambled to work remotely with students relying on videos, emails, and phone calls. New requirements to reopen schools will depend on infection levels within communities and will likely require a mix of in-classroom instruction and distance learning from home. Maintaining lower classroom density and other forms of social distancing in public areas are top priority. School staffing remains a major concern, as 35% of the state's school employees are eligible for retirement. Many are expected not to return to their jobs in order to avoid jeopardizing their own health and safety needs. With the unpredictability of COVID-19, officials say Oregon schools are facing substantial uncertainty, and even with preliminary plans in the works, ongoing changes and adjustments should be expected. In Seattle's South Park neighborhood, a cleanup coalition formed after the Duwamish River was declared a Superfund site in 2001. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
In a resilient community of South Seattle, neighbors are showing up for neighbors in a big way during the coronavirus pandemic. South Park is a small industrial neighborhood along the Duwamish River and the most diverse in Seattle, according to the 2010 census. About 90% of children qualify for free and reduced-price meals at school. It's also a community that's used to supporting itself. At the onset of COVID-19, South Park resident Lashana Williams, a massage therapist and death doula, says folks began hosting food pantries from their homes, delivering hot meals to people who couldn't go out, and created a utility and rent fund.
Everybody sort of said, this is what I can offer. How do I plug in? And that's what's happening. Everybody's doing a little bit of something.
Folks in the neighborhood began communally shopping, and Williams says donations have rolled in to their GoFundMe page from across the country. South Park residents have a history of standing up for the neighborhood. They fought off garbage burning and rezoning in the 1960s, garnering this headline in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, South Park, a square mile of defiance. The community also has pushed back on environmental hazards. Paulina Lopez is head of the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, formed after the river was declared a Superfund site in 2001. She says air pollution has decreased in parts of Seattle, but not South Park, where industries continue to operate.
Looking at the trends of New York and California, they've been publishing some of the reports and how communities that are impacted already by air pollution have been the most vulnerable and the most impacted by COVID.
Because at least 30% of South Park residents speak a language other than English at home, Lopez's group also has been working with the University of Washington to create multilingual information about the virus. Williams says it's a working-class neighborhood where people have to show up to support each other.
When your means are not of money, your means are from the heart and from your abilities and from what you know you can do.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting from Lornette Tornbull for Yes Media.
Memorial Day festivities drew crowds of people, many exhibiting reckless behavior by ignoring coronavirus restrictions, potentially threatening communities. With states gradually beginning to reopen, public parks, beaches, and recreational areas have urged people to maintain social distancing and continue wearing facial coverings when in public. But these warnings were largely ignored last weekend in many areas across the nation. In rural North Carolina, thousands packed the stands shoulder to shoulder at Ace Speedway on its opening night. Despite event cancellations, hundreds of partygoers reveled in Daytona Beach, with people crowding the streets and boardwalk areas. Similar scenes could be witnessed at beaches, bars, and poolside parties in St. Louis, Missouri, Ocean City, Maryland, and in Houston, Texas, among many other locales. Amid the festivities, COVID-19 claimed another 2,000 U.S. lives over the weekend. Local officials sounded the alarm Monday morning, warning consequences could be dire if such behavior remained unchecked. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner vowed to crack down on businesses failing to enforce coronavirus restrictions, while St. Louis County Executive Sam Page urged a 14-day quarantine to all partygoers who flouted social distancing. Page told the Washington Post, quote, this reckless behavior endangers countless people and risks setting us back substantially from the progress we've made in slowing the spread of COVID-19. Despite legal ramifications and public safety restrictions, many business owners are saying that their community's economic stability relies on states and counties loosening restrictions put in place because of the pandemic, especially in those areas that rely on tourism and seasonal attendance. A wrong-way police chase on I-84 may end up costing the city of Portland $125,000. On Wednesday, the city council will vote on a settlement with cab driver Ethiopia Amdino, who was injured in a head-on collision on Interstate 84 on April 19, 2018. The settlement would pay Amdino and avoid the possibility of a greater settlement cost if the matter were to go to court. The incident occurred following a Portland police officer's wrong-way pursuit down the freeway, where a white Toyota Celica crashed directly into Amdino's Toyota Prius cab. Officer Alfonso Valadez Jr. was found to be in violation of the city's pursuit policy, which calls for police chases to be objectively reasonable. The oncoming driver, 59-year-old Christopher Canard, died in the collision, while Amdino's cab was totaled and he was rushed to a nearby hospital for injuries. Valadez attempted to stop Canard after a minor hit and run, resulting in Canard driving the wrong way onto eastbound I-84 from 99th, with Valadez in pursuit. Valadez had previously been fired from the police bureau due to off-duty behavior in 2015 and had been back on the job for roughly 2 weeks before the wrong-way chase. Police Review Board unanimously found that the pursuit was in violation of their policy and created, quote, undue risk to public safety. Valadez resigned from the police bureau on September 20th, 2019, after the Portland Police Disciplinary Review Board approved his firing. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Pioneer Courthouse Square time capsule. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a warm high of 82. Today in history, in 1897, the first copies of the classic vampire novel Dracula by Irish author Bram Stoker appear in London bookshops. The quote of the day is from Bram Stoker's Dracula, where he wrote, quote, "We learn from failure, not from success." Of a black man in Minneapolis, Minnesota, now has the FBI on the case after a video emerged showing a police officer with his knee on the man's neck. The victim, who has been identified as George Floyd, is shown in the video handcuffed, saying he couldn't breathe as the officer pressed on his neck with his knee for at least 5 minutes until Floyd lost consciousness. The incident occurred shortly after 8 p.m. when the officers, who have not been publicly identified, arrived on the scene after responding to a report of a forgery in progress. They were advised that the suspect appeared to be intoxicated and sitting on top of a blue car. The officers ordered Floyd off the car, and according to police reports, he resisted. Police were able to handcuff him and then take him to the ground. This is when the officer put his knee on Floyd's neck, ignoring his protest that he could not breathe as another officer stood by passively. An ambulance arrived shortly after Floyd lost consciousness, taking him to a local hospital where he died shortly after arrival. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey held a press conference this morning and delivered some very strong remarks, indicating that the officer failed to observe any protocol. Mayor Frey said in his comments, quote, "Being black in America should not be a death sentence. When you hear someone calling for help, you're supposed to help. This officer failed in the most basic human sense. All I keep coming back to is this. This man should not have died," end quote. According to the mayor, the four officers involved have been fired. More than 100,000 people in the five major U.S. territories are military veterans, but they can't vote for president. With more in the story, here is Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The number of people who have stood up in the territories to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces, to defend American democracy, to defend democracy abroad.
Today, over 100,000 veterans live in the five major U.S. territories, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, the Northern Mariana and U.S. Virgin Islands, and Guam. Neil Weir founded Equally American to promote equal rights for all Americans, no matter where they live.
Two of my close friends growing up in Guam were actually killed in service to this country, and you know, their families continue to be disenfranchised.
Yesterday was Memorial Day, first created in the aftermath of the Civil War. It now honors and remembers all the people who have lost their lives in the U.S. military. Guam has the highest percentage of veterans among the territories. Only five states have more. Despite defending the U.S. Constitution with their lives, American citizenship, and generations of lobbying, the territory's 4 million people still have no congressional representation and can't vote for president, except people who've moved to the states. Juan Bibiloni left Puerto Rico to attend Iowa State University.
Right now, sadly for Puerto Rico, we have a brain drain going on. A lot of young professional talent is moving to the States because of the situation and bankruptcy of the government. But now when we go to the States, we have the right to vote.
New York has the highest number of Puerto Rican voters. Florida is second and is the nation's largest swing state, likely to play a major role in November.
Definitely with the diaspora of Puerto Ricans going to the mainland, you know, especially in battleground states like Florida, you know, the Puerto Rican vote is much more important now than it was before.
Puerto Rico, along with usual elections for governor and local offices this November, will have yet another referendum asking citizens if they want their territorial status changed to regular statehood. University of Florida Professor Carlos Suarez says Congress hasn't acted on referendums in the past, and he doesn't expect that to change.
They are for what happens on the island, and not necessarily, quote unquote, a solution to the status problem, as it's called in Puerto Rico. Because what you see is that political parties make use of these elections to mobilize people, because what they do is that they hold these referendums on the same day of elections for the other positions. So it's a carrot, if you will, to attract people to vote.
But Suarez thinks that might not work anymore, that Puerto Rico residents might be more immediately concerned about the economy and disaster relief than about the island's legal status.
Do people really care to vote because of the USPR relations? Or is that eroding for a host of reasons? Puerto Rico has been in a great recession, if you will, or economic recession since 06. You had the hurricane and the poor response to Hurricane Maria. You had the governor ousted last year. Well, it will be interesting. I have no idea.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Mescalero Apache tribe, located in south-central New Mexico, has declared a state of emergency as COVID-19 cases have started to emerge there. With that story and more, it's Art Hughes with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico declared a state of emergency Monday as tests confirmed the first cases of COVID-19 on the reservation in New Mexico. At least four people tested positive for the disease. The tribe says it's waiting on the results of some 600 other tests. Mescalero officials ordered a lockdown on all businesses and public establishments for at least the next 2 weeks. The tribe is also closing tribal government offices to the public. The order puts restrictions on individuals' movements and asks that one member of each household use Tuesdays and Thursdays for buying food and other essentials. The tribe is closing entrances to tribal land, although the main highway through the reservation remains open. Mescalero President Gabe Aguilar told KRQE-TV the measures are a way to protect the tribe. He says merely urging people to practice physical distancing failed to keep the virus from spreading. An out-of-state seafood worker is the first person to test positive for coronavirus in the city of Valdez, Alaska. Officials say the infection was caught through routine testing. Louisa Castrodale is the acting infectious disease program manager for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. In a video conference Monday, she said it's not clear yet how the individual contracted the virus.
This individual came to Alaska from the lower 48 in late April and was quarantined on site there for 2 weeks. Was asymptomatic during that time frame as well and has been working on campus since then and has not left. It's not clear the source of the infection, whether this was something that was picked up locally since the person had been there for a month, or whether this is the test that we're seeing, the positive result, if it's picking up virus that might have been an infection in the distant past, and we're just seeing residual virus from that.
Castor Dale says health officials are working to determine anyone who may have come in contact with the infected person. Alaska officials remain vigilant as the commercial fishing season is getting underway and thousands of people come from all over the world to work in processing facilities. The state has a little over 400 positive cases of COVID-19 total as of the start of this week. The regional hospital in Nome closed to the public after an employee tested positive for the coronavirus. The Norton Sound Health Corporation expected employees to go back to work Tuesday after all of them are tested for the virus. KTOO News reports the facilities were subjected to a four-day extensive cleaning. On Friday, the city manager issued an emergency order restricting travel into Nome and mandating a two-week quarantine for anyone traveling into the city from the outside. Some face masks sent to the Navajo Nation through a company established by a former White House aide may be inadequate to properly protect those who wear them. The news organization ProPublica reports almost 250,000 of the masks sent by a company headed by former White House Deputy Chief of Staff Zach Fuentes may not fit the guidelines established by the Food and Drug Administration. ProPublica reports the total cost for the masks is around $800,000. The report goes on to say that another 130,000 masks are not the kind specified in the procurement data. The news organization says Fuentes secured the $3 million deal with the Indian Health Services 11 days after he formed the company to sell personal protective equipment. IHS officials say the masks are unsuitable for medical use. The regional office is determining whether to return them. Fuentes told ProPublica his connections to the White House played no role in his company's selection as a provider for IHS. The Navajo Nation has the highest per capita rate of coronavirus infections in the nation. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
The nonprofit La Luz Center in Sonoma County, California, aims to make the community more resilient and help it recover from wildfires. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When deadly wildfires tore through Sonoma Valley in 2017, a local nonprofit called La Luz Center stepped in to help residents who were displaced or without power. It provided food, financial support, and Spanish language information to its predominantly Latino clientele.
People would come in, they'd have a hot meal, they would grab donated items.
But Sandy Sanchez, the center's director of programs, says after the flames were extinguished, people's recovery process had only just begun. Many of La Luz's clientele lost jobs. So as the surrounding community started to rebuild,
we thought, okay, there's going to be an increase of jobs in construction. How can we prepare our community to line up for those jobs?
So the center started the Building Trades Training Program. It's a bilingual course that prepares low-income people and those displaced by the fires for entry-level construction jobs. So far, more than 100 people have participated. The center has also started offering mental health counseling. Sanchez says it's a holistic, long-term approach to recovery that will help the community become more resilient as disasters grow more common. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Major dam failures in Michigan last week point to a larger, more systemic problem with aging infrastructure and climate change. With that story and more, it's This Week in Water.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Two dams failed in Michigan last week after torrential rains caused the Tittabawassee River to reach its highest level ever recorded, a foot above the previous record.
The Edenville Dam collapsed, causing the Smallwood Lake Dam downstream to be overwhelmed, inundating Midland, a city of 40,000.
The disaster put the spotlight on aging dams across the country and how climate change could lead to their failure if improvements aren't made.
Weather Underground reports that both of the dams, built in 1925 and owned by Boyce Hydropower, were rated as being high hazards, meaning that the loss of human life was likely should the structures fail.
Last November, the Associated Press released an analysis showing that nearly 1,700 dams in the U.S. were rated as high hazard and were in poor or unsatisfactory condition.
In 2018, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission revoked the license of the Edenville Dam, but didn't require the private owner to make improvements.
The floodwaters threatened Dow Chemical's facility and Superfund sites downriver. The New York Times reports that the inundation could erase the progress that has been made cleaning up the river by stirring up contamination and spreading it downstream.
Central Michigan has seen a dramatic rise in precipitation over the last century, which is consistent with predictions that human-produced climate change will increase rainfall in the mid-latitudes of the Earth, including the upper Midwest.
Trees offer many benefits in urban areas, such as improving air quality and keeping cities cooler. But tree canopies are declining, and one of the culprits is leaky natural gas pipelines.
A study conducted by the Boston University School of Public Health found that in one Massachusetts community, dead or dying trees along sidewalks were 30 times more likely to have been exposed to methane in the soil than healthy trees.
The researchers think that the gas had leaked from pipelines that are buried beneath adjacent roads because they found elevated concentrations of methane in the dirt between the trees in the street.
Inside Climate News reports that methane, the primary component of natural gas, is about 80 times more potent in warming the atmosphere than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period, which makes plugging even small gas leaks important.
Bumblebees rely heavily on pollen for essential nutrients as they build their summer colonies. But what do they do when there's a shortage of pollen?
Researchers have discovered that they puncture leaves with their mouth parts, which has the effect of forcing plants to bloom on average 30 days earlier.
One of the scientists involved in the study told Scientific American that they were observing bumblebees in an unrelated experiment and noticed the insects were damaging plant leaves.
The researchers knew that stress could cause a plant to flower, so they wondered whether the bees might be creating the blooms.
So they put pollen-deprived bumblebees in with mustard and tomato plants, and the bees soon cut holes in the leaves of each.
The researchers tried to reproduce the same type of damage using forceps and a razor, but the plants punctured by bees flowered weeks earlier, which suggests that there might be important chemicals in the insect's saliva.
The bees that puncture plants do not live long enough to benefit from their efforts. Future studies will likely look at how the bumblebee behavior evolved and whether other species do the same.
Speaking of pollen, people with hay fever might look forward to rainstorms, thinking that the allergen will be washed out of the air, but that's not what happens.
Researchers at the University of Iowa have determined that bits of pollen remain in the air after a storm for up to 11 hours.
Pollen grains are tough, but can rupture when exposed to high humidity, like during a rainstorm. The storm's winds lift grains into the clouds until falling rain sends fragments back toward the ground.
Those fragments are extremely small and don't settle on the surface, but can remain aloft and potentially get into people's lungs. The researchers found that there was a significant increase in pollen fragments after it rains heavily and recommend that people who have allergies stay indoors, especially after a thunderstorm.
And finally, international borders are often designated by lines drawn on a map, or they can follow natural features like mountains, rivers, or lakes. But what happens when they're delineated by a glacier that's melting because of global warming?
That's the situation that Refugio Guide del Cervino finds itself. The mountain restaurant was built high in the Italian Alps, but now might be in Switzerland.
In 2009, Italy and Switzerland agreed to a moving border in recognition of melting glaciers. GPS units were installed along the glacier and watershed to track any shifts.
The glacier has receded enough in the past 15 years that the restaurant may now be in Swiss territory. And as Glacier Hub reports, that could be a huge headache for its owner, Lucio Trucco, who would suddenly be subject to Swiss taxes and potentially even duties for every box of pasta brought to the restaurant from Italy.
And as the World Economic Forum writes, it could also mean that the restaurant would need to switch electrical outlets to meet Swiss codes. Trucco disputes the new border, saying the building hasn't moved an inch and is still in Italy.
Shifting borders may be an unanticipated consequence of climate change and a possible source of conflict or peace. India and Bangladesh disputed control over an uninhabited sandbar that might have had oil and gas reserves, but rising seas made the island and the problem disappear.
However, shrinking glaciers that supply fresh water in the province of Kashmir, long a point of contention between Pakistan and India, could make a tense situation worse if they disagree about who owns them.
That's it for this week in water. We'll see you next time.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 26th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Art Hughes, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, we'll hear Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon, bringing residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw features art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Art Talk Bus Stop, speaking with Leif J. Lee, a multidisciplinary art currently based in Portland. Then at 11:30 on Radio Zine, host Suzanne LeGrand speaks with authors Gate Hendricks and Carol Klein about their recently published book, Conscious Luck, 8 Secrets to Intentionally Change Your Fortune. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Living under a stay-at-home order has changed much of Oregonians' day-to-day lives. As Portland Metro residents enter their third month under the statewide stay-home order, Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square is creating a crowdsourced digital time capsule showing how they've spent time at home, specifically in their living rooms. Pioneer Courthouse Square, sometimes called Portland's living room, is not a gathering place now due to social distancing orders. The Living Room Time Capsule project will compile short videos submitted by locals in order to encapsulate this period of time. I spoke with Teresa Vetch Sandoval, who is the director of marketing for Pioneer Courthouse Square, to learn more about where the project originated and how people can participate. So I understand the Pioneer Courthouse Square is asking for community members to participate in a crowdsourced time capsule video related to the pandemic. Can you tell us about that project?
I sure can. I think it was just important to us, since we have not been able to sort of gather in Portland's living room since this pandemic has started, that we hear from community members and really get a sense of what they've been doing in their own living rooms. Really, the overarching theme of this project is from Portland's living room to yours. And we just really wanted to hear from community members like throughout the region and just basically document what they've been doing. As we know, many living rooms have been turned into classrooms, and gyms and home offices, and we just were really wanting to get a sense of that, and also just for people to know that we are all still together, even if it's in our own living rooms. So what we're asking community members to do is we're going to be producing a short video documenting this virtual time capsule, and basically there's two questions, which are, what were you doing in your living room during the quarantine, and what are you looking forward to about being back in downtown? Because I know that we'd all like to be back and out again at some point. If people are interested in doing this fun project, and they can just go to our website, and we have a full step-by-step on how to submit. It's very easy. So our website is thesquarepdx.org, and head on over there, and you can go through the steps of then submitting your video. And videos, we ask that they do not exceed 60 seconds, because that's just a... And then we're going to be working with a company called Softbox Films to edit and produce a video, which will include participants that have submitted videos. And it'll just be a nice culmination of kind of what our community has been doing throughout this pandemic.
Very cool. I'm curious, where did the inspiration for the project come from?
Well, actually, it sort of evolved. So when this whole crisis started, we actually decided to do, you know, because we are Portland's Living Room, we wanted to do From Portland's Living Room to Yours. And we worked with a local artist, Larry Yes, to put a big ground sticker in the square with a positive message. And it says, "We are together." And then this sort of formed out of that. So that was sort of the phase one. It's still down at the square, and people can view it via the KGW Skycam. That's the top of our building. And from there, we just were like, you know, we've now reached people in their own living rooms virtually. And then we've also began virtual programming 5 days a week on our social media channels. And we just thought, you know what, let's have, you know, a second phase of really going into people's homes, I guess, and like getting them involved and having them submit a video, because I know this is a virtual time capsule, but we also have like an actual physical time capsule at the square. So we just thought it would be a really good way to remember this time and, you know, kind of how it was affecting people. So it will definitely be, it's a definitely a historic time worldwide.
What are you hoping that people who participate get out of it?
We really hope that they just, you know, share their stories with us. And kind of, it will be fun to see what everybody has been doing, you know, in their own living rooms, because we can't gather in Portland's living room. So we are just looking forward to, you know, sharing in this time with them, and just wanting to also know, a lot of these people follow us on social media too, and just the way to kind of know what our followers are doing during this time.
Yeah, and so once the video is put together, how will that time capsule be used in the future?
Yeah, once it does get put together, we're going to showcase it on our social media channels, and then we'll also be putting that on our website as well. We have on our website currently just like the time capsule that's down at the square and what that contains, and then we'll also have this one, and we'll be promoting it, and it'll basically be a part of our archive.
Gotcha. So people who are interested and they want to participate, they need to go to your website, yes?
Yes, thesquarepdx.org, and they will be able to, there'll be a pop-up box like right in the, on the homepage, and they can just go right to it from there.
And cell phone video is okay?
Oh, absolutely. That's what we feel like many people will do. Yeah.
Teresa, do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners before we wrap up?
Sure. We would just really be appreciative of the community if they participate in this time capsule video. And because, like I said, we know that there'll be some good stories out there to share. And we just know that we're all in this together. And so we would just love to hear from the community.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
We've been speaking with Teresa Vetch Sandoval, the Director of Marketing for Pioneer Courthouse Square. More information on the crowdsourced time capsule project, as well as instructions on how to participate, can be found at thesquarepdx.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. The COVID-19 pandemic has had disparate impacts on people of different groups. One such group are those affected by the opioid crisis, who face increased accessibility issues during closures related to the pandemic. Social distancing can make it harder for them to prevent overdoses. I spoke to Dr. Sheila Vicaria, who is the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance, to learn more.
So you work at the Drug Policy Alliance. What have you seen to be the relationship between the coronavirus outbreak and the overdose crisis?
What we're starting to see on the ground and what we've been hearing from folks is that the very conditions that have created the situation that we're in terms of the overdose crisis, the structural and social and policy challenges that have led to rising inequality, lack of access to health care, lack of access to housing, mass criminalization and mass incarceration, those very same challenges that are fueling the overdose crisis are in a lot of ways the same exact challenges that are also fueling the harms associated with the COVID pandemic right now. And unfortunately, a lot of the same communities that are being marginalized by the very policies that are putting them at risk for overdose are going to be experiencing even more risk to their health and well-being because they're also at risk for COVID-19.
So specifically, what are those contributing factors?
Sure. So one of the things that we know that drives overdose risk is using alone or using and not having someone around who can respond with naloxone or Narcan or not being able to call 911. And what we know is that good overdose prevention education in communities tells people always have a buddy, always make sure to have naloxone on hand, and you know, if you're concerned about someone's well-being, call 911 to get help. And what we're seeing is that in light of COVID-19, what we've been recommending to folks, unfortunately, while it's good for prevention of COVID-19 exposure or transmission, is going to be putting folks at risk for overdose because we're encouraging folks to socially distance, which may mean isolating from others so that people are actually perhaps using alone. It may mean that the very programs that are distributing naloxone and sterile syringes are now limiting their hours and exposure so that people are less likely to have naloxone on hand when they do need it. And that it also means that 911 and emergency response has to rightly prioritize potential people who are struggling with COVID infection. And so it may mean that those who are calling with other medical emergencies may have delayed response times, which can actually mean the difference between life and death in the case of an overdose.
Right. And you spoke to this a little bit, but how does that limitation on non-essential medical treatments impact things like the overdose crisis?
Well, it differs from state to state in terms of whether, harm reduction services such as syringe service programs that often distribute sterile equipment and naloxone are able to stay open or not. And it can differentially impact people in states where, unfortunately, those programs are deemed non-essential, so that people may now all of a sudden go from having access to not having access at all. But even in states where we know that syringe service programs and harm reduction programs are deemed essential, we are still seeing that these programs are having to adapt to the risk environment that they're in, and that they're having to modify their service structure, they're modifying their schedules, they're perhaps not open during all of the same hours or all the same days or in the ways that they were before, which means that at the end of the day, that the folks using those services are going to be most at risk for not being equipped to protect themselves and take care of themselves. That's kind of one of the challenges that we're facing, is that whether they're deemed essential or not, can mean that people may or may not have access. But even in states where they are deemed essential, unfortunately, they're still not functioning at the full capacity that they were pre-COVID.
Right. You know, according to the Oregon Health Authority, an average of 5 people in Oregon die per week from opioid overdose, and that's, you know, outside of the coronavirus outbreak. So sure. Given the constraints of the COVID-19 pandemic, what can health officials and policymakers do to better respond?
So there are some policies that have been changing at the federal level, which are heartening and potentially can do a lot of good. You know, one of the things that we do know to help prevent opioid overdose and reduce the risk of lethal overdose is getting people who have opioid use disorders access to evidence-based medications such as methadone and buprenorphine. And prior to COVID-19, policies were incredibly restrictive, and some would argue that they still are today. That only certain licensed prescribers can prescribe buprenorphine, that you could only get methadone by visiting your clinic daily, that you had to be initiated onto these medications through in-person consults, that oftentimes there's a counseling requirement that requires you to show up in person. And a lot of these barriers can actually restrict access and have still continued to drive overdose deaths before COVID-19, but are now risk factors for putting people in situations where they're going to be congregating and going to treatment providers. And so SAMHSA, the DEA, several larger federal governing bodies recently just changed some guidelines to make it easier for people to get onto these medications and for those who are currently taking these medications to stay on them. So one thing that's been positive that's rolled out is loosening the number of days that people have to come in to get dosed on methadone and allowing people to get up to 14 days of take-home medications, if not upwards of 28 days to take home. And we know that the more you can stockpile on your medications and not have to go in to get your medications at your pharmacy or at your clinic, the more likely you are to reduce those exposure points where you might be congregating and perhaps getting exposed to COVID-19. And so, you know, one thing that states can do and places like Oregon can do is ensure that methadone clinics and buprenorphine providers are fully taking advantage of these loosened restrictions so that clinics are, to the maximum extent possible, allowing these take-homes up to 14, if not 28 days. Because what we're hearing is also, unfortunately, across the country, even though these larger federal guidelines have changed state to state, but even within states, at clinic to clinic, some of these policies aren't really being implemented to the fullest extent they could be. And what ends up happening is that it still means that people who are trying to get on these medications and stay on these medications, which can reduce the risk of lethal overdose by 50%, are unfortunately still being subjected to having to go into programs where they might be exposed to the virus. So, you know, doing whatever we can at the city and the state level, but also on the clinic level, to make it easier for people to get on these medications is a huge step in the right direction to address the overdose crisis and to continue to try to do the best that you can. The other thing that we need to consider is that even in light of restricted potential hours of syringe service programs, how do we develop novel strategies, perhaps mail-based strategies, to send people injecting equipment, but also naloxone, to their homes directly? And we've been hearing some really promising stories coming out of states like New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio with mail-based naloxone access, really making it so that people don't have to leave their homes to get this medication, so that they can potentially reverse an overdose in case they witness one. So like policies like that can be really, really helpful in terms of reducing the risk of overdose.
Yeah, expanding what that idea of access looks like. So obviously those you know, the restrictions that we would deal with in a normal time, those are based on a certain, I don't know, view of, you know, opioid use. Do you think that that is changing at all, or that, you know, the idea of what is accessible enough will change?
We really hope so. I think, you know, so much of the restrictions around these medications were grounded in fears of, you know, illicit diversion of these medications, or fears that people couldn't be trusted to take home their doses without overindulging. And really, I think a lot of those fears have not been grounded in the reality of so many people who take these medications dutifully every day, who just want to be well, who just want to be able to do the things that they want to do in their day-to-day lives without feeling restricted by, you know, having to report back to a program. So, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, a decade-long overdose crisis didn't drive these policy changes in medication access, but it had to take a pandemic to do so. And there's many of us on the ground who were saying, you know, perhaps even these policy changes were a decade too late, but we're grateful to see them now. And sure, that hopefully what we'll see is that it'll end up saving a lot more lives during this crisis, and that we'll learn our lessons, that patients can be trusted with their medications, and that, you know, the sky didn't fall when we loosened these restrictions, and perhaps this means that we need to change business as usual. Absolutely.
So what is one thing that you think is maybe misunderstood about the overdose crisis and how it intersects with coronavirus?
I think that people often forget that many people who use drugs are very much the same exact populations who we should be concerned about, who have those very high risk factors that we've been talking about in terms of the populations that we should be protecting. A significant number of people who currently use drugs often do have co-occurring physical health challenges, if not are immunocompromised. And these are the exact people who we've been saying from the beginning need to be afforded more protections and more allowances to be able to reduce their exposure to this virus. And so when we think about COVID prevention and we talk about sheltering in place, for instance, we have to remember that a significant portion of people who are homeless or unstably housed are often also people who use drugs and who are often also people who are immunocompromised. And so when we think about even, in, you know, simple suggestions or seemingly simple suggestions like shelter in place, some of those very same guidelines are actually not feasible to some of the most marginalized people in our communities. And so we need to think of novel strategies, right? And so there are cities across the country that are having real and frank conversations. You know, how do we allocate, you know, vacant hotel rooms to the most at risk in our communities? Because even shelters and expanding shelters will not be the solution if people are still forced to congregate and can still be breathing in the same air as one another, right? So we need to remember that, you know, certain guidelines that we've made still may not be feasible for all people. And how do we make sure that when we make these guidelines that we truly are protecting the health of everyone? You know, and so when I gave the example of access to these medications, you know, one of the biggest messages that we've been sending to everyone with complicated health problems for which they're receiving medications is, you know, try to get the maximum amount of your prescription available so that you can reduce your time going back to the pharmacy. And unfortunately, we've forgotten the fact that the one medication that we actually say saves lives of people with opioid use disorder is one of the only medications for which you actually have to continue to go back several times a week to get, right? So, you know, remembering that, you know, certain policies may have to look different, or we might need to adapt our policy recommendations, or at least acknowledge that other groups are going to need more support to even engage in some of these practices that we want to do to help them stay safe.
Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners before we wrap up?
You know, I think that we as an organization, the Drug Policy Alliance, are really trying to advocate for policies that we know will help promote the public health more broadly, but particularly among people who use drugs. And one of the things that we're doing in the state of Oregon that I think is really exciting is that we are supporting ballot initiative IP44 in Oregon right now, and are hoping that in November we'll get on the ballot an initiative to reduce the punishment of people who use drugs and actually increase access to treatment and keep people out of jails who actually really need help. And I think if your callers are interested in learning more about how to support people who use drugs and getting them access to the services that they need and making sure not to fill up our jails and our prisons with people who use drugs who could probably benefit from being part of the community, I'd recommend them look into it. And they can get more information at yesonip44.org. We still need 8,000 more signatures to be able to make it to the November ballot, and we'd really appreciate the support of Oregonians on this.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Vicaria, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We have been speaking with Dr. Sheila Vicaria, the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance. More information on Initiative Proposal 44 is available online at yesonip44.org. More information on the Drug Policy Alliance is available at drugpolicy.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. We wanna smash, crash.